Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for taking your afternoon to spend some time with us here for another edition of Midrats. If you are new to the show, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. It's a place where you will find the usual suspects in the chat room. And if you have some observations about the show you'd like to make or some questions you would like for us to direct to our guest, that's a great place to fold them in there, and we'll be monitoring that during the course of the show. Likewise, if you have to head out halfway through the show and you want to catch up on what you missed or you want to see what we have to offer in previous episodes, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can go and take the shortcut and just subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes. But hey, let's go ahead and get on with the show. Our guest for the full hour will be here to discuss kind of some macro issues, at least to start off with, on some of the challenges that we are facing with the American military. And we're going to use as a starting point today a recent article of his over in the National Interest titled "The Real Problem with the American Military." Our guest is going to be a returning guest. We always enjoy having him here. Can't believe it's been a year since we've had Dakota Wood on. He is a senior research fellow on defense programs at the Heritage Foundation. He's also a lieutenant colonel, U.S. Marine Corps retired. And he served 2 decades in the U.S. Marine Corps. And following retirement, he served as a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budget Assessments. More recently, he also served as a strategist with the U.S. Marine Corps Special Operations Command. He has a Bachelor of Science degree in Oceanography from the U.S. Naval Academy and a Master's degree in National Security and Strategic Studies from the Naval Command and Staff College and also the U.S. Naval War College. Dakota, welcome back to Midrats.
Hey, it's great being with you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Glad to. And I also wanted to mention, if people wanted to catch up on some of Dakota's thoughts and observations, just go ahead and Google Notes from Thermopylae, Dakota Wood, and you can find his blog there as well, in addition to a lot of things that he works for over at the Heritage Foundation. But just as a kind of an opening salvo, so to speak, when you come in, you read some of the trade publications, or what a lot of people are comfortable talking with, they want to go through programmatics. They want to talk about F-35 on the naval side, maybe LCS, more general terms, force structure, morale, competence, budgetary issues. But in your article, "The Real Problem with the American Military," you really bring out an argument that the real problem is larger. It's more fundamental. It's more baseline. What was the premise of your article and the points that you want to bring to the reader?
Yeah, I think we get captured by chasing bright, shiny objects. There's always the latest fad, whether it's a concept, an intellectual concept, or a widget, you know, some kind of program, as you mentioned, an acquisition item that people really fixate on. And everybody that is talking about that, almost to the exclusion of discussing how it fits into the larger pattern of military operations and military affairs. And I think what we find, if we would just step back for a moment, almost like you would read Ecclesiastes, you know, there is nothing new under the sun, right? So anti-access area denial is one of these things, A2AD. I tend to think that fortifications in the old days was that same thing. You're trying to protect access to a port or a harbor. You build a fort, it's got big cannons, and your ability to keep people out of your neighborhood was the extent of that cannon reach. Well, technology marches on, you have a longer reach, you have an improved ability to see who is in your area, but conceptually, it's an old issue. But somebody will come up with a new term or a new way of describing things. It could be global strike. It could be revolution in military affairs, RMA, air-sea battle, A2AD. All of these things that pop up into discussions, and people will fixate on them. And then they will try to tie their acquisition program or some physical capability that they're trying to sell to that latest idea. And people start spiraling around that, and I think get distracted from the fundamental aspects of warfare. That is imposing your will on an enemy, being tactically competent and proficient, and making sure that you can get out of your base, deploy to the area of operations, defeat your enemy in combat, and then be able to bring your guys home if that's the objective afterwards. So, again, I think there's a lot of intellectual distraction and programmatic distraction that blends together with the last decade of current operations and counterinsurgency and counterterror that has caused people to really limit the scope of how they think about warfare.
When you look at that side of the topic, how much of this lack of focus on the fundamental purpose of the military, which, as you say, is to impose your will on others or intimidate other people so they won't do things you don't want them to do or will do things you want them to do, how much of the confusion over that role is caused by the effort to turn the military, it seems to me, sometimes into an agency for societal change? Is that a distraction which causes not to focus on the war fighting structure the way we should?
Yeah, I think it's one of about three or four primary thrusts here. One could be somebody in a position of authority can impose a regulation or a policy objective on the military. And because of the subordination of the military to civilian control, which is absolutely essential, and we don't want to change that, the military is going to salute smartly and be in military guys and gals are trying to execute that as best they can. So somebody who isn't as well informed on military affairs can start dabbling in this social experimentation or using the military to advance a social or a political agenda with much less resistance than you would find in broader society. So I think that's one aspect of it. Another aspect is just lack of familiarity with military affairs and with the tides of history, with people who get into senior political office. They come up through a different track. It could be business. It could be social activism. It could be a purely politically wonky kind of path in life. Haven't really studied history. They don't really understand geopolitics. And so their perception or their understanding of the consequences of what they try to impose is wrong. On the military side,
Hello, Dakota, you there? I thought it was on my end in the middle of a storm.
No, I think he just fell off the map.
Okay, well, let me
call him back.
Okay.
You dial him back.
The joys of live radio. I think what we'll do is let's do something radical and call him. and I won't say his phone number over the air this time.
Okay.
I thought it was patience for all our listeners. Live radio, all you got.
Hey, we're back on.
Hey, there we go. Pick up where we left off.
Absolutely. I think this is an example of when people become absolutely convinced that technology is the solution, you get a call drop and it proves to you how unreliable these certainties really are. What I was saying is that in the military itself, you have people who will grab on to the latest fad idea. Sometimes it's whole of government. Sometimes it's total force. Sometimes it's an almost apologetic treatment of their own service that well, the Army's the greatest thing and blah, blah, blah. But we can't do anything without air power or sea power or with our good friends, the Marine Corps. And it starts to muddle this thinking. Instead of clarity on the tool that you have, how the tool can be best applied in a given set of circumstances, the limitations of that tool, and how military activities can actually amplify or augment, or when political and economic measures aren't viable, they can be the solution. So, you know, I think it's all of these things coming together, a desire for social engineering, misinformed policymakers, military personnel who have really not made a study of military affairs, their own profession. And out of that mixture, we get bad ideas that tend to distract people from what they should be focused on. And that is, am I developing the military that we need to be effective and to be a winning force in combat? Because that's what it all comes down to there at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think you've hit on a great point that we brought up in the course of the show a few times, and I wanted to get your angle on it. And you've kind of answered it anyway, but it's one of my happy places, so I'd like to dive in there for a minute. And these types of trends and habits, intellectually speaking, amongst leadership, they're decades in the making, because it takes decades to make a general officer or a flag officer, an SES, or occasionally we get a youngster, or civilian appointees. But you know, let's look at the military side of the house, where I think sometimes there is a danger of senior leadership become of D.C. as opposed to in D.C. and almost try to be politicians themselves. But let's talk about what you mentioned about history. We all know the state of the education of history in our general population is horrible. Everybody knows that, but nobody in the education system seems to want to do anything about that. But we can control what's inside of our lifelines. And there's an appreciation of our history that is lacking in our officer corps. And anybody who's had a chance to serve for an extended length of time with European militaries, they have a much greater understanding, not just of their history, of military history in general. Staff rides are a regular basis. Into your third liter of beer, a German will forget his English and start talking to you in German about things. It's amazing. But they've inculcated that a little better than we have. And I wonder if part of that comes from, at least on the naval side of the house, we intentionally are injecting an error into our greater intellect through a lack of intellectual balance and intellectual diversity. And that has to do with the fact we say you have to have 85% of our ROTC guys have to have a technical degree. And everybody knows what it takes to get a degree in electrical engineering or mechanical engineering. You don't have time to sit around and take seminar courses. So that's our population we're injecting. So is there any really surprise that we don't have leaders who have themselves or encourage amongst the junior personnel an appreciation of history because they're all technologically focused? And does that lead into some of the things you mentioned about technology fetishism, where we think everything's going to be solved by a celestial network that is one circuit breaker away from going bye-bye, which we've seen in history in other areas? Is that part of our baseline problem, is the intellectual makeup of our military?
Yeah, I do think it is. I think a couple of contributing factors are trying to push things too early. As an example here, you'll take a young lieutenant or a captain. They've never deployed abroad in a real sense. You send them into Afghanistan, and now all of a sudden they're supposed to be masters of the human terrain. And they're going to sit down across cups of tea with an elderly guy, 60, 70 years old, who has grown up in a culture that's 1,500, 2,000 years in existence. And somehow you're going to convince him that the Western way of doing things, you know, educating his women or having paved roads or developing an appreciation for maintenance procedures on farm tractors, you know, whatever that is, that this young 25-year-old is going to master that conversation, when the guy probably is going to be challenged at putting together a good control package, keeping track of all his folks, understanding how to manage radio networks, call for fire, and all the tactical things that you really should be proficient at. So I think we try to ask too much of the military in some areas, and we don't ask enough of it in other areas, and that being in military affairs. Now, as somebody grows up in the military, and this gets to your point, you have to graduate out of the pure technical aspects of your profession and get this broader perspective. But I think that comes from with maturity. And that doesn't mean immaturity in an adolescent sense. It means maturing in experience, in wisdom, in exposure to historical studies and warfare from different periods. So in the past decade, 12, 15 years or so, almost everything has been counterinsurgency and counterterrorism, stability operations, human terrain, and mastering the narrative, right? We somehow tend to forget that there are big war things, like we experienced in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, and even in the opening salvo of Operation Iraqi Freedom. And with regularity, every 15 or 20 years, the United States finds itself in a major war. And if you look at our history since the Revolutionary War, that's the case. Every 15 or 20 years, we've got big war, and we get distracted. And I think in comparing the United States to our European allies, they are both blessed and cursed to have contiguous borders with other countries, and sometimes they have fights across those borders. The United States is blessed and cursed with massive oceans and fairly quiet neighbors to our north and south, right? So we have the luxury of getting distracted into all kinds of philosophies and higher order types of thinking, where we tend to think we believe we have graduated out of the messiness of hand-to-hand combat, bayonet drills, machine gun fire, and concertina. So I think it's a bit of all of this, that the senior leaders don't pay attention to the study of military affairs. Bright, shiny objects on the technical side you can't ignore, because that's where money is, and that's where you have to fight for programs. Nobody has to fight to get congressional approval for an operational concept. So you can be very loose in your thinking on that, or you have to be very concrete at getting a multi-billion dollar program funded and sustained across several administrations. And we can find ourselves caught. So the recent experiences of all of our mid-field grade and higher are Afghanistan and Iraq and stability and counterinsurgency. And the new guys coming in are being taught by instructors who have those as reference points. So what we really need is for the senior leaders to step back, appreciate that there is more to warfare than the experiences of the last 10 years, and start to inculcate an appreciation of history and the lessons that history has to teach us while somebody is becoming tactically proficient and being a non-commissioned officer or a company grade officer.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because it was my experience that tactics and history were not things we worked with very much on the ships I was on, but we sure did go through a litany of what I would call cargo cult thinking, that if we apply this particular management technique, we're somehow going to solve all our problems. I mean, we went through MBO, we went through LMET, we went through Deming, we went through Covey's Seven Habits. We should have been studying Sun Tzu and Chairman and Mao, for that matter. But we got caught up in that.
And Nelson, and you know, some great name of Mahan, you know, Corbett. I mean, yeah, that's what you should have been studying. And if you look, I mean, sorry, I just jumped on you, but boy, you just really plucked a chord there. If you go back and you see what Brian Clark is writing at CSBA on missile inventories and offensive capabilities aboard ships, if you look at Captain Wayne Hughes out at the Naval Postgraduate School and flotilla tactics and Greenwater Navy operations and those kinds of things, that's the kind of thinking we need to see in the U.S. Navy, not debates over management techniques, as you just pointed out.
Sal, it's up to you.
There we go. It's a little thing called a mute button. Sometimes it can be a challenge to find. And let's pull the thread on that a little bit for Clark and Hughes, because I agree with you. There are some great intellectual efforts going on out there. And I'm just going to stick to the Navy side of the house here. I'm going to mention the Marine Corps side of the house, my next question. But that's not what we're hearing from the CNO, from the vice CNO, or some of the senior vice admirals. They are stuck on issues. Let's totally redo our personnel system, and here's 10 items, five of which apply to everybody, but five of which they won't say are focused on one thing, making it woman and family friendly. Full stop.
Right.
That's why they're doing it. We have the vice CNO, who I don't know what she's doing, but she's not engaging on issues, legitimate issues, like Clark and Hughes goes, that have to do with why you have a fleet. What is a fleet supposed to do? How does it support the national security structures? And we've kind of touched on this again, but I think we're kind of seeing a rut in the road here. Is this an issue, and I'll bring it up again when I mention my Marine Corps question here in a bit, that we find our leaders not so much focused on military issues, but supporting socio-political issues that the civilians are emphasizing? Is that really a requirement on their parts? And in the zero-sum game that there is, every time the CNO speech has a speech, every time the vice CNO has a speech, every time you have the Fleet Forces Command send a half a dozen people across the country for a seminar, that you can't get more than 24 hours a day. So that intellectual effort, and if you want to be a J4 type, the TAD funding, why is that being expended on such unserious items when, and two paragraphs later, they'll complain about sequestra?
Yeah, you know, these I guess what we're calling social issues really are a simple matter of leadership, right? You know, the ethics associated with being a good soldier, sailor, airman, marine, or what have you. But when we have the national military strategy that was just released, and it has a big section about sexual harassment, sexual abuse, sensitivity types of elements, it's not right to say that those aren't important. I mean, those are critically important because they reflect values and who we are and how we appreciate, respect, you know, each other and all that. But I don't think that those are elements of a military strategy that should be prioritizing the efforts within a military service and how you engage, you know, close with, engage and defeat an enemy in combat, right? So some issues are more appropriate in other venues. When we're talking about the tactical and operational and even strategic value of the effectiveness of a military service like the Navy, that's not in that wheelhouse. So we have senior leadership in the Navy, the Department of the Navy, that are concerned about alternative fuels, you know, the whole green energy initiative with surface combatants. We're more concerned, as you said, with rank structures and what percentage of your force is represented by some kind of minority group. And I would hesitate to ask for some kind of a report on the ship handling and ship fighting competencies of personnel that are out aboard destroyers and cruisers and aircraft carriers at the moment. So I just think that we've got our priorities backwards when it comes to fielding a fighting force, and that the issues that are dominating the time and attention of senior leadership, both in D.C. and out of the fleet, are elements of leadership training and that people should be becoming exposed to and having reinforced in the course of their daily, you know, training and how we interact with each other. So, hopefully I haven't conflated the two, but I am in agreement with you, and I think we have lost focus on the warfighting purpose of military forces, and we have subordinated proficiency and effectiveness in those areas to these other more political and social types of issues.
Yeah, I was pleased to see the other day that the surface warfare community in the Navy is developing sort of a top gun for surface warfare officers, where they're going to have, dare I say, a center of excellence where the outstanding young officers can go and learn how to do things like ASW and Lord knows what else, amphibious warfare and stuff, and then go back to the fleet and carry that knowledge and help train their shipmates. That seems to me to be a good focus on getting back to war fighting, albeit kind of a small potatoes effort compared to what probably should be done.
Yeah, I mean, how do you array your fleet in the world's oceans in such a way that you can apply offensive firepower against the other guy's fleet or his shore installations or whatever the target is and protect your own fleet? I mean, I don't know that we're really good at that as good as we should be. The focus has been on ballistic missile defense. It's been on fielding the littoral combat ship and trying to figure out how that plays in, renaming it to a frigate. Manpower rotational issues because of downsizing, trying to free up funding for SSBN recapitalization and the Ford class carriers. That's really it's been dominating discussion. And you're just not seeing the kind of thinking that we've mentioned that Brian Clark has been trying to get out there and others. Jerry Hendricks, great intellectual. Brian McGrath has been doing some really good stuff. Again, Wayne Hughes and company out at Monterey. That's the kind of stuff that really should be generating a lot of serious discussion in naval circles about fleet architecture, fleet capabilities, and fleet operational concepts.
Speaking of great thinkers, somebody called my attention in a very good way yesterday, and it tied in with a book I just finished reading, Bob Grenier's 88 Days to Kandahar. Really great first-person account that somebody wants to get, at least from the CIA perspective, the first half decade of our operations in, mostly Afghanistan. He touched on Iraq a little bit because he's involved there as well. But the last chapter of the book, he rightfully laments what happened intellectually in our military after President Obama's December 2009 speech at West Point that effectively announced a withdrawal under fire. And he talked a bit about his disappointment on the, and he's not a military guy, he's a CIA guy. The military leadership's lack of a response to that. Part of it was trying to be a good soldier, making the best of it, but he implies that there was a little bit of denial, cognitive denial going on, where people were hoping that eventually they would shift to conditions-based, but of course from the beginning it was all calendar-based, though we did get the calendar to shift to the right a bit. And I saw last week General Dunsford, the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Senate Armed Services Command Committee, he said something that broke above the ambient noise when Senator Manchin, a Democrat of West Virginia, asked him, quote, what would you consider the greatest threat to our national security? And Dunsford, very direct, to the point, and my assessment today, Senator, is that Russia presents the greatest threat to our national security. It follows later on saying, and again, this is General Dunsford, quote, Chairman, from a military perspective, I think it's reasonable that we provide that support to the Ukrainians. And frankly, without that kind of support, then they're not going to be able to protect themselves against Russian aggression, period. End of quote. What struck me about that is you don't become... General Dunsford didn't become General Dunsford by not being very, very clear, direct, and conscious of every word he says.
Right.
He was very aware that by saying that, that doesn't necessarily put him in contrast to the civilian political side of the house, but it does set an emphasis to a marker that can make people uncomfortable, which I think is part of actually senior military leadership's job. Do you agree with my general view of what General Dunsford did? And is that the cowbell that we think we need rung a little bit more from the uniform side of this house?
I think so. I mean, H.R. McMaster has been doing this. John Gentile has been doing it. Mattis, before he retired, was very direct in his commentary. Dunsford, I think, is a real breath of fresh air. And these are people who look about the global landscape and they see actors like Russia It's been very militaristic in how it's been dealing, very aggressive in how it's been dealing with its near abroad, as they would term it, there in Eastern Europe. And they're saying, look, we might have to actually go to war with these guys. History tells us that this happens, you know, like I mentioned, from time to time. And we are doing a disservice to our men and women in uniform, setting them up for failure if we don't get serious about this. And here is an interesting element that never comes up in discussion in the Washington, D.C. environment. You have the services that will push forward a particular platform, F-35, LCS, Ford-class carrier, next-generation submarine, I mean, you name it, right? Whatever that big thing is. And they'll say, Mr. Congressman, we need to have this because China or Russia or Iran is developing some sort of capability that's in that next generation class. And by golly, if we don't have something that can defeat their platform, then you know the game is up. And yet you don't hear the conversation going along about, okay, do you in fact envisioning going to war with Russia or going to war with China? Well, everybody pulls back from that in a heartbeat. They'll say, no, we won't go to war with China. I really can't envision the scenario. We're going to solve the Russia thing diplomatically. Well, if the military isn't thinking through the implications of actual warfare with China and Russia, then why are they pushing so hard to get equipment that is predicated on just that discussion? You see what I mean? And so I think we've got folks like Dunford and others who are bringing that up, looking at the character of these countries, where they're making investments, and how they are operating in their neighborhoods, and saying, we have to be prepared to defeat them in battle. And if that isn't framing our thinking, then we're not thinking the right way.
You know, as I was reading your article and from the National Interest, I saw you were channeling Fehrenbach, T.J. Fehrenbach, a little bit there. And since one of my favorite books is his A War Like This, I think that's what it was called, about the Korean War. Talk about that a little bit. You also list him as an important historian. I don't think many people are as familiar with him as Clausewitz and some of the other folks you mentioned in the article.
Yeah, well, I mean, Bing West has been doing that. Fehrenbach, you know, older now, obviously, writing back there in the Korean War era. Victor Davis Hanson is a classicist historian. They look at the reality of battle. So countries come together in some kind of conflict over terrain or trying to impose a political ideology or they want a raw material or resource of some type. There is some reason that drives countries into conflict. And when that happens, for at least one of those competitors, you know, the objectives are all out. I mean, this is total war for them. They're committing themselves to winning that battle. Oftentimes, America is not in the total war construct. We can commit what we want to commit to it, but it's not a do-or-die situation, and we can pull out, and the United States continues to exist. That isn't the condition for some of these other countries. So folks like Fehrenbach were saying, we have deployed forces into the Korean theater. Let me tell you what warfare is like and what is necessary to be successful in that kind of war. You need hard men. You know, it was almost all male back then. Hard men who are rough and ready, have been trained for the rigors of combat, and who have been enabled and directed, as a matter of fact, to grapple with the enemy and to defeat him in close combat. That's the kind of thinking that he was writing about, the realities of warfare. And these other writers that I mentioned in that article were very clear-eyed about that as well. If you look at China and the PLA Navy, most of their ships aren't anywhere near the quality of ours, but they have quantity. And on a small, kind of antiquated ship, you can put a fairly modern anti-ship cruise missile on that thing. And if you're fielding 400 or 500 vessels that are in their Navy, and you take the United States Navy and deploy a third of that perhaps, let's say 90 ships on any given day. We've got 50 or 60 in the West Pacific. The Chinese certainly have a numbers advantage. So if the Navy isn't figuring out or thinking through how to win in naval warfare at a 4 or 5 to 1 disadvantage numerically, then they're not applying the intellectual resources that they should to deal with the realities that T.R. Fehrenbach and these others have written about.
Yeah, you hit on the subject that can drop me into a funk fairly fast. I have liked some of the conversation recently. Again, it's using different words to establish things that have been true forever. But the discussion of distributed lethality. And I think somebody you mentioned before, a prior guest here, Brian McGrath, has also been very good in reminding everybody of our almost criminal lack of punch on the surface side of the house. And one could even argue from the aviation side of the house, kind of reminds me of the 73 Arab-Israeli war when the Russian missile ships were coming out, and all of a sudden we realized that our entire air wing was designed to pummel Vietnam, not to, to go to war at sea. And so there is some discussion about needing to reach out and touch, to find ways to force the national will on an opponent, but all that's just talk at this point with a little bit of money behind it. You know, we talked recently about Dunsford and McMaster and Gentile. Have you seen on the Navy side of the house at least somebody with USN after their name with at least three stars that are willing to step out from the front of the ranks and bring that this type of conversation to the front so it can actually start to impact in the budget and in decisions?
No names come to mind. I wish I could report differently. And maybe there is somebody, but I can't recollect anybody in recent memory that has been writing along those lines.
Yeah, I've been looking and sadly just haven't been able to find them.
Yeah, most of the thinking that we're talking about is occurring outside of the active Navy, which is a real shame because it should be the Navy that's having that debate within it. You know, if you're going to put men and women on a warship, call it a warship, and send it into harm's way, they had better be ready to go weapons free and be able to fight their ship, you know, against an enemy force, save theirs, you know, if they can, certainly battle damage, those kinds of things. But they have to be able to fight their ship. And with that comes greater risk tolerance for being more aggressive at sea, and not so mindful of whether or not you got all your BQS checks in the box and your sexual harassment training done to the border. So, again, I think it's a misprioritized approach that we have in the operating forces. The enemy, potential enemies, certainly look at the numbers and the capabilities of the ships that we put to sea. We kind of do that number counting exercise. We publish an annual report on Chinese military power. But nobody really accompanies that with any serious discussion of that being a warfighting force and how you would engage that in battle and win that kind of outcome. It's really just a numbers game, or it's a justification for looking at their technological maturity and ensuring that we're buying things that are much more technologically advanced. But I see almost nothing in discussions within the Navy, the active Navy community, about warfighting and about warfare at sea. It's very much a defensive mindset. It's ballistic missile defense, or it's the support of projective air power or cruise missile strikes that targets far inland.
Well, we also seem to be doing a lot of discussion, perhaps magic thinking, about drone warfare, some of which is kind of cool, drones that follow enemy submarines and stuff like that. And I guess the nice thing about that is that it's very hard for a drone to sexually harass anybody, so you can throw the checklist out the window. Are we guilty of, or potentially guilty of, relying too much on an unproven technology with all these drones we think we're going to have? And where the hell is the is the resource, electronic resource, going to come where we can manage these things?
Yeah, we should be quadrupling our budget just to bring out a factor in experimentation and in fleet exercises to figure out where unmanned systems, both undersea, surface, and air, fit into how you fight your fleet. I think it's been much more or too much of committing to these advanced technologies to where we are going to become critically dependent on them, and we really don't understand the vulnerabilities or even the advantages when you actually have to go into war, right? So prematurely committing to large-scale adoption of unmanned systems without the necessary experimentation and fleet exercises where you figure this stuff out before making national security dependent on it.
I've been saying it for the better part of 15 years, and it, obviously I'm losing the argument, but I've always said if you buttress everything you have on the electromagnetic spectrum, you will lose war at sea. Full stop. And unfortunately, we seem to be going that way. I wanted to get your go back to history again, because this is something I've been noodling at, and I'm really having trouble being able to translate it for some people. But trying to find an example of the challenge that we are facing and what we're seeing with the Islamic State in their operations in Syria and Iraq, from a strictly cold-blooded point of view, it looks like the only effective fighting forces are the Kurds and Assad. So if you really, really hate the Islamic State, you have to be comfortable making everybody nervous by letting the Kurds do what they need to do, and you need to get over your dislike of Assad. But as far as how the Islamic State, what are they doing? What is their ultimate plan? What can we reference and go, they're very similar to that? Yeah, trying to look at various historical examples. I don't like people when they throw out Nazis. I don't think that's right. That's ridiculous. You know, you can go to fiction. There's a little bit of Conan's Tulsa Doom there, but from as far as the brutality and the ruling by terror and making a positive nature out of it, something along the line of Tamerlane's campaigns, where you make the mounds of skulls, and a little bit of the Crusades against the Cathars in France in the 12th and the 13th century, where we got the kill them all, let God sort them out phrase from. What are some historical examples that would help explain the challenge of the Islamic State better, or do we have something that really is a new flavor?
No, it's a group of people who have no compunction at all in using extreme violence to impose their will. And in fact, it's not just no compunction. They actually grab onto this as the preferred instrument, the preferred tool. So you could look at drug cartels using extreme violence, you know, vats of acid, beheadings, systematic torture to cow their competitors or the local law authorities into submission. You could look at the Khmer Rouge and what they did in Cambodia. You could look at what the North Korean regime does to itself and to its people to maintain power through intimidation, violence. Saddam Hussein used this tool against any faction that was even suspected of harboring illusions of creating its own power base. He used rape rooms, he used systematic torture and intimidation and coercion of subordinate officials. He would hold family members hostage to ensure compliance by people who he had in various sensitive positions, had half a dozen different intelligence services, secret police that he would pit against each other. So I think this is it's a type that we have seen before. The reason it is so successful in the Middle East is that you have incompetent forces that it is engaged with, that don't have the willpower or the material resources to stand up against it, combined with a lack of any desire of an external actor, either a Western power out of Europe, the United States. It actually serves the interests of somebody like Russia or China because they don't have any moral or ethical qualms in dealing with somebody like the Islamic State. So they're able to do what they want to do because they have seized on extreme violence as the preferred mechanism or tool to kill anybody or to intimidate anybody who's in their way. So I don't think it's an unusual story. I think it's an old story. That we have just gotten into an emotional, psychological state of affairs here in the United States where we don't want to wade into very hard problems where you have to get your hands dirty and where there isn't an immediate exit strategy that's viable, and it's going to take a while to achieve a particular political objective. So this little toes in the water approach we're doing right now is probably the worst possible approach, and that for a propaganda value, the Islamic State can say, see, we are continuing to achieve success on the battlefield, even with the United States involved trying to support the Iraq government or whomever else. So the U.S. prestige suffers, our influence is lessened, frustration builds within the United States about being involved at all, and we don't win on any front whatsoever. So I think the Islamic State represents either an all-in or an all-out type of scenario. If we decide not to get involved, then don't waste a single U.S. life. Let bloodshed reign. We'll see who comes out of that dust, and then we deal with whatever that actor is, you know, years from now. Or you go all in, absolutely crush them in open warfare, and we would win at that, albeit with some casualties. And then you would have to determine in going in that way, what is the U.S. national strategic interest in the Middle East to maintain a presence and shape that environment that meets our political objectives. So that kind of debate has not occurred, and the current administration obviously wants to get out of wars, not get into them. And I think they're looking for an 18-month plan that allows them to get out without committing to another ground war in the Middle East.
I think you go ahead, Elon.
Well, I was just going to say that we don't learn the lessons of history. We don't learn that when Iraq invaded Kuwait, that the ruthlessness with which they intimidated that population, the bodies hanging from the lampposts. Well, you know, we've let that go, and people then argue, well, there was no reason to replace Saddam. You know, if you're in for a pound. In for a penny, you should be in for a pound. And I think when we started doing this ISIS thing, I quoted Fehrenbach on my blog and said, you know, the whole thing about you can fly over land forever, but you can't hold unless you put troops in the ground. You really need to decide. Somebody needs to decide what are we serious about that? If we're not, then it isn't worth anybody, any American life. And as the other people say, let God sort them out.
Yeah, you know, the ground forces, the Army and Marine Corps would say that you're insane if you decide to go to war without supporting air power. I mean, why wouldn't you want a long-range, you know, weapon system that can kill your enemy at distance and attrite him, attrit his capabilities so that when you do eventually clash, he's suffering casualties and losses. You know, you love air power, right? But air power doesn't win wars. I mean, we've got almost 100 years of experience that says that just doesn't happen. Like you said, it could fly over, I could bomb places, but you know, you look at the Battle for London, where the Germans were pummeling the British landscape, you know, London into submission with repeated raids, and Londoners were still going to the shops, you know, they're still trying to, you know, adapt to conduct life. Obviously, they didn't like it. They fight back. But it's amazing what people can adapt to and to continue to work. We saw that in the Balkans and Kosovo and, you know, Bosnia and all that stuff. So people are amazing in adapting to long-range fires and figuring out how to continue to make life work while the war is underway. It's land power that seizes terrain, holds terrain, and denies that terrain and population from the enemy force. And it's the only way you decisively defeat an enemy force as well. So, but that involves you to commit your sons and daughters to that kind of combat, and you will see casualties. If you decide that the consequences aren't that great or the interests, you know, national security interests aren't that great to do that, then you're going to cede that landscape to the enemy. That's what we're seeing in Eastern Europe with Crimea and portions of Ukraine that Russia is dismantling, its intimidation of the Baltics and the Nordic Straits, etc. They have a willingness to wade into the fray. At the moment, we do not. And so you're seeing spheres of influence and the control and influence over populations expanding via actors like Russia and China.
Let's talk about Eastern Europe for just a little bit. In the last few months, we've seen desert painted M1s tooling through the Baltic forest in Estonia. I guess it's time to repaint them black and green again. That's always funny. It's like during Desert Storm, the Marines deployed dark olive green tanks. So we're always painting for the last war, if nothing else. We have some, the 173rd Airborne is doing what they're supposed to do. We've also got some other advisors and a few exercise and staff programs in Western Ukraine. It seems, maybe it's just bad reporting, but why do I have the impression that the USA cares more about Eastern Europe than the Western Europeans do? Do they not see it the same way we do? Or do they, but they're just falling back on the old habits of free riding? If Uncle Sam will do it, then all we need to do is make nice noises and save our budgets for other things.
They have 20 or 30 years of painting themselves into the corner that they cannot now extricate themselves from. So if you adopt socialism in whatever guise as your socio-political economic structure, and the state provides all kinds of things for a population, then when you have to commit or you need a military capability, you don't have the financial resources availability to field that. You know, as you know, you can't invent a military overnight. So the entirety, I said that again, the entire United Kingdom military force, the Army, the Royal Marines, the Air Force, the Navy, the totality of that manpower is smaller than the United States Marine Corps alone. So what do we expect the United Kingdom to contribute to anything in a big war that you might have with Russia? And France has gotten into the same predicament. You see where Italy and Greece are at, and Spain, Germany perhaps, but politically, socially, and economically, all of those countries are at a point where they have no viable option to physically stand up to the aggression in Russia. So they see the Russian reality for what it is, but they don't have any tools in their kit bag other than diplomacy and woe-is-me-isms to respond to that. So you're seeing Angela Merkel and Hollande from France basically kicking Ukraine under the bus, because there isn't the wherewithal politically, socially, or economically to do anything else.
Well, the trick now is, though, that Putin seems to be casting an eye on the small NATO countries that used to be, mm-hmm. you know, the little Baltic states up there. And you know, any foot that a Russian soldier steps across the border there invokes that section of the NATO agreement. So right. I'm not sure how long Europe can hold out on that view.
Well, I mean, NATO is basically ineffective as a military force. You know, the United States, as a consequence of the happy decade of the 1990s and our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan through the 2013-14-15, caused us to draw down in Europe. So we basically had two brigades left. Neither one of those is an armor brigade. So we've got no active tank, you know, heavy armor forces. We've drawn down attack aircraft just on and on and on. So America was the muscle behind NATO military power. The other countries made significant contributions, but they were additive to what the Americans brought to the table there. So when you look at the 28 member NATO countries, only four, I believe, maybe five, are contributing 2% or more of their GDP to defense expenditures. One of those five is Greece. And the only reason they're above 2% is that their economy is in tatters. And a couple of the others are the very small countries who have only recently joined NATO or are very small, you know, Estonia, for example. So all of the big players are at the 1.5%, 1.4%, 1.2% level, which is below the bare minimum of contributions from their economies to funding a defense that you could actually meaningfully contribute to some kind of NATO response. So it's underfunded, it's understrained, it doesn't have any real capability these days, and so it's no surprise that NATO as an organization is loath to say that this Russia push into these areas, whether it's the waters around Norway and Sweden, or the land space there in the Eastern Europe, or all of the intimidation that it's been doing against the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. They're loath to say that these are problematic in a military sense, and they're hoping to negotiate them away until Putin gets tired of taking things.
Yeah, it's the 2% argument. It's always been one of my little markers I look at too. You know, the 2% I think is very useful because that's just national effort. Whether you're a $1.3 million Estonia or if you're the USA, you know, it's that percentage, doing what you can. Yeah. And that's one helpful measure. But then there's also the practical utility. NATO's been in Afghanistan for a decade. In that 2% club are the Greeks and the Turks. The Greeks absorbed oxygen on staff, and the Turks hung out in Kabul and didn't do much besides that. So there's also will. Unfortunately, we're coming near the top of the hour, but I didn't want to leave before we gave you a chance. I always like to point our listeners in the direction of good reading material and reference point and thought pieces. And over at Heritage, y'all have the 2015 Index of Military Strength. What can the reader expect to find there, and what would be a good way that they could use that to help inform themselves?
We recognize that there was no single source document that Congress or the public could use to understand the state of military affairs. So if we have national interests and we're dedicating a certain percentage of our budget to military stuff, it really does develop the question, how are we doing in this area? And at best, what you would get is service chief testimony and the annual budget drill during the spring, but there is no consistent reference that measured how threat environment is going, how the world looks like as an operating environment, or the status of U.S. hard military power capabilities on a year-to-year basis. So we put this index together. The 2015 is the inaugural index. It discusses the world, threats to U.S. interests, the state of affairs of the U.S. military complex, gives them a grade. Unfortunately, it's not very good these days. And the second edition we'll have rolling out here this coming October.
Well, it's my turn. As Sal said, we're running down into the show, so I'm going to ask the classic. First, I want to thank you for being on with us today. It's been a very fast hour. And what can we look forward to seeing from you here in the next few weeks or months that would be of interest to our audience?
Yeah, we're coming to closure on the second edition of this index. So you know, a lot of editing, a lot of writing, so getting to that and then putting the layout so we can actually publish it. We've got a larger project. We're just getting started, and that's an effort to rebuild America's military, but that's, you know, it's a few years in development, so there's nothing really coming out of that. What we're trying to do is publish pieces that inform Congress and the public about the good or the bad of policies and how they affect U.S. hard military power. And unfortunately, we see a lot of bad decisions. Sequestration is killing the military. The reduction of the Army by another 40,000 soldiers, taking us from 45 down to 35 brigades, now to 32 brigades, is just disastrous. And what it does is it hamstrings U.S. national leadership in responding to challenges like the Islamic State, Russia, China, North Korea, or Iran.
And on that note, Dakota, I wanted to really thank you for taking time this afternoon. Like Eagle One said, man, what a quick hour. Really appreciate it. And we'll be looking forward to reading more of your good works here and coming for the rest of the year.
Great. Hey, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed the conversation. You guys do great work, and hopefully you can be on again.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for this edition of Midrats. And until then, have a great Navy and, for you, Dakota, Marine Corps Day. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks, Dakota.
Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.